Friends, I don't want you to get your hopes up too high. This title, The Guardian of the Faith, is too large for a discussion one evening. And I'm not sure it will be a great pleasure after you hear what I have to say. But let me begin by telling you that it is not about the ministry of the guardian as such. It's not an attempt to survey his writings. It is really about the guardian as a person, as an infant, a child, a student, adult, though features of his work may be touched on to illustrate characteristics of his personality. It is too about how he was prepared for the guardianship. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. This quotation from the book of Isaiah formed the basis of a question addressed to Abdu'l-Bahá by a Western believer who took it to mean that after the master, a child would lead them. The verse is drawn from chapter 11 of that book, which opens with the declaration, "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots." We learn from God Passes By that the metaphor rod out of the stem of Jesse is an allusion to Baha'u'llah. This is how the master replied to the question. "O maidservant of God, verily, that child is born and is alive, and from him will appear wondrous things that thou wilt hear of in the future. Thou shalt behold him endowed with the most perfect appearance, supreme capacity, absolute perfection, consummate power, and unsurpassed might. His face will shine with a radiance that illumines all the horizons of the world. Therefore, forget this not, as long as thou dost live, inasmuch as ages and centuries will bear traces of him." While such curiosity was being expressed from the West in the context of prophecy, anxious questions about the future of the cause of God were being whispered among the friends in the East, especially residents of the Holy Land and visitors who were aware of the rebellion of Mirza Muhammad Ali and his companions against Abdu'l-Bahá. I want to quote to you briefly from the memories of 9 Days in Akka, the book written by Dr. Yunis Khan of Fructe, who served Abdu'l-Bahá here for 9 years, beginning in 1900. He writes this because he was here at the time. In fact, he was here in 1897 on a visit. And he heard these things, not only here at the Holy Land, but they were talking about the rebellion in Baghdad and in Tehran. And there were arguments that were were brewing among some of the believers. He writes, "The elders of those days, whether pilgrim or resident, who were acquainted with the history of the faith and had from the dawning of the Son of Truth seen many of the major events associated with the establishment of the cause, found a great resemblance between the behavior of the arch-breaker of the covenant and that of Baha'u'llah's half-brother, Yahya Azal. While reminiscing about the past, they also engaged in speculation about the future." We Baha'is are always speculating, you know. "The severing of the unfaithful branch and the remaining violators of the covenant from the blessed tree of the faith of God was a matter of certainty." In other words, they knew this person couldn't succeed Abdul Baha. They knew that. "Therefore, the question that emerged was, how will this affect the future of the cause?" But he goes on, "I did not find this type of discussion very pleasant and refused to speculate about the future or participate in such discussions, for I could not bear the thought that one day Abdul Baha would leave us forever. Then I heard the whisper that from the sacred lineage of Baha'u'llah, a new babe had been born and had been named Shoghi Effendi. Although my whole being was thrilled by the news, I did not wish to associate the dawning of this sparkling star with the setting of the shining sun of the divine covenant. In so doing, I prevented myself from deviating even as much as a hair's breadth from the blessed verse, 'Turn your faces toward him whom God hath purposed.' I convinced myself that worrying about the future was of no use, that today was the day for confirmation and education of the believers, and that tomorrow was in the mighty hand of the sovereign Lord of the faith of God, who was able and unconstrained." He then goes on to tell us of an experience he had during this visit in 1897. He says, "For some time, the residents of the Pilgrim House had shown great interest in seeing Shoghi Effendi. They pleaded continually with the illustrious Afnan," you know, the father of Shoghi Effendi, Mirza Hadi Afnan, or Shirazi he was called, "in the hope that such longing by so many might be realized. Quite by chance, one day, this babe of only 4 months was brought to the Biruni of Abdul Baha's house. The friends were beside themselves with joy, and I too hastened to pay a visit to that beloved infant. But I made every effort to look at him in no other light than as a Baha'i child. However, a strong urge compelled me to bow my head and observe the deepest respect. For about a minute, I was utterly captivated by the beauty of that face. I gently kissed the soft hair of his blessed head, and as I did so, I felt an indescribable quality in that infant. I could see his likeness to the pictures that I had seen of the infant Jesus in the arms of his mother Mary. For several days, an image of his shining face was before my eyes, but gradually it faded. I had similar emotional experiences twice more. Once, when he was in his 9th year, and once when he was 11. Mirza Haydar Ali and I were intimate friends and often shared each other's secret thoughts. I related to him the details of my visit and the nature of my impressions. and found that he shared my understanding of the situation. And we decided to keep the matter quiet. Praise be God that the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá has been read and the secret revealed at last. So he, of course, read this many years later when he could say that. All right, yes. The secret was revealed in the second paragraph of the first part of the will and testament in a dramatic flourish of language using rich metaphoric allusions, the meaning of which was immediately clear to the believers in the East. Listen to this from the Will and Testament. Salutation and praise, blessing and glory rest upon that primal branch of the divine lotus tree, grown out, blessed, tender, verdant, and flourishing from the twin holy trees, the most wondrous, unique, and priceless pearl that doth gleam from out the twin surging seas. Now, Westerners like me wouldn't understand all of this metaphor, twin surging seas and all of that, but it's very clear to these, I'm sure, to the people here. And of course, the fact is that we had in the marriage of Abdu'l-Bahá's eldest daughter with this gentleman, Mr. Shirazi, a combination of the two families, he and Afnan, she and Aksan, and so the twin surging seas, you see, and so on. Now this greeting, this marvelous salutation, benediction, was bestowed on others in this paragraph, hands of the cause of God, believers who were firm, and so on. He says, upon them, for behold, he said, he is the blessed and sacred bough that hath branched out from the twin holy sea trees. Well is it with him that seeketh the shelter of his shade that shadoweth all mankind. On 1 March 1897, the first child of Abdu'l-Bahá's eldest daughter, Diyaye Khanum, and her husband, Mirza Hadi Afnan, was born. This male infant was the first grandchild of Abdu'l-Bahá. Abdu'l-Bahá revealed a prayer in which the name Shoghi was conferred on the child. The prayer went like this: O God, this is a branch sprung from the tree of thy mercy. Through thy grace and bounty, enable him to grow, and through the showers of thy generosity, cause him to become a verdant, flourishing, blossoming, and fruitful branch. Gladden the eyes of his parents, thou who giveth to whomsoever thou willest, and bestow upon him the name Shoghi, so that he may yearn for thy kingdom and soar into the realms of the unseen. Indeed, it is said that the word Shoghi means longing, yearning. The master insisted that the honorific Effendi, sir or mister, be added to the name and used by everyone, so that even the father of the child addressed him as Shoghi Effendi. Some years later, at the request of Shoghi Effendi, the master gave him the surname Rabbani, a name which was also used by his siblings, distinguishing them from other branches of the family. Ordinarily, I suppose they would be known as Afnan. It became evident in earliest childhood that Shoghi Effendi was of a special nature. This was reflected in the unusual quality of the relationship that bound him to his unique grandfather. The priceless pearl, Amatul Baha Ruyakarnam cites the account of Ella Cooper, an early Western believer. She was a pilgrim at the time. Of a meeting she witnessed between Abdu'l-Bahá and Shoghi Effendi when he was just 2 years old. This is what she wrote. One day, I had joined the ladies of the family in the room of the greatest holy leaf for early morning tea. But the beloved master was sitting in his favorite corner at the divan where, through the window on his right, he could look over the ramparts and see the blue Mediterranean beyond. He was busy writing tablets, and the quiet peace of the room was broken only by the bubble of the samovar, where one of the young maidservants, sitting on the floor before it, was brewing the tea. Presently, the master looked up from his writing with a smile and requested Zia Khanum to chant a prayer. As she finished, a small figure appeared in the open doorway, directly opposite Abdu'l-Bahá. Having dropped off his shoes, he stepped into the room with his eyes focused on the master's face. Abdu'l-Bahá returned his gaze with such a look of loving welcome, it seemed to beckon the small one to approach him. Shoghi, that beautiful little boy, with his exquisite cameo face and his soulful, appealing, dark eyes, walked slowly toward the divan, the master drawing him as by an invisible thread until he stood quite close in front of him. As he paused there a moment, Abdu'l-Bahá did not offer to embrace him, but sat perfectly still, only nodding his head two or three times, slowly and impressively, as if to say, "You see?" This tie connecting us is not just that of a physical grandfather, but something far deeper and more significant. While we breathlessly watched to see what he would do, the little boy reached down and, picking up the hem of Abdu'l-Bahá's robe, he touched it reverently to his forehead and kissed it, then gently replaced it while never taking his eyes from the adored master's face. The next moment he turned away and scampered off to play like any normal child. At that time, he was Abdu'l-Bahá's only grandchild, and naturally, he was of immense interest to the pilgrims. So these are pilgrims' notes. Shoghi Effendi was small-bodied, fine-boned, growing up to a height shorter than his grandfather's, but he was physically more like his great-grandfather, Baha'u'llah. Ahmadu'l-Bahá describes him from his first photographs as having a peaky little face, immense eyes, and a firm, beautifully shaped chin, which in his childhood gave a delightfully elongated and heart-shaped appearance to his face. She wrote of the expressiveness of his face and of his eyes, which she said were of a clear hazel color and sometimes changed to a warm and luminous gray. It is said that the greatest holy leaf spoke of his hands as having been like the hands of her father, Baha'u'llah. Amatul Baha described them as more square than tapering, strong, nervous, the veins standing out, very expressive in their gestures, very assured in their motions. Shoghi Effendi was a small, sensitive, intensely active, and mischievous child, she wrote, explaining that she did not mean to be disrespectful by saying he was mischievous. "He told me," she said, "he was the acknowledged ringleader of all the other children, bubbling with spirits, enthusiasm, and daring, full of laughter and wit. The small boy led the way in many pranks. Whenever something was afoot, behind it would be found Shoghi Effendi." This was not to say he was mannerless, she pointed out. Indeed, how could Shoghi Effendi or any of the other members of the master's family be other than courteous and mannerly, qualities that were taught from the cradle? The liveliness of Shoghi Effendi did not go unnoticed by his grandfather, who wrote a short sentence to please his little grandson. It said, "Shoghi Effendi is a wise man, but runs about very much." It is reported that at 5 years old, he was pestering the master to write something for him. In his own hand, Abdul Baha wrote him a letter. This is what it said. "He is God. Oh, my Shoghi, I have no time to talk. Leave me alone. You said write. I have written. What else should be done? Now is not the time for you to read and write. It is the time for jumping about and chanting, oh my God. Therefore, memorize the prayers of the Blessed Beauty and chant them that I may hear them, because there is no time for anything else." Right. How do you suppose Shoghi Effendi responded to this? He began to memorize a number of Baha'u'llah's prayers. He would chant them loudly enough to be heard throughout the neighborhood. This aroused concern in his parents, you know how parents are, and other family members. In his own defense, Shoghi Effendi was heard to say, "The master wrote to me to chant that he may hear me. I am doing my best." That said, he kept up chanting. When the parents begged the master to stop him, he told them to let Shoghi Effendi alone. Now, let us talk a little bit about his schooling. This is as a very small child. Shoghi Effendi's schooling began at home in the house of Abdullah Pasha. You know, he was born there. Classes were conducted there for the master's children. These were taught by an old Persian believer and at one time by an Italian who acted as governess. Eventually, the master sent the young boy with a nurse to live in Haifa, where he attended the French Jesuit school, Collège des Frères. Shoghi Effendi was not happy at this school. This we learn from the notes of Dr. Habib Moyad, a devoted believer residing in the Holy Land for some time, who was assigned by Abdul Baha to look after Shoghi Effendi. Despite his unhappiness, Shoghi Effendi completed his studies at Collège des Frères. He then went for advanced studies to a boarding school in Beirut, also run by the Jesuits. His unhappiness there increased, and Abdul Baha had him transferred to the preparatory school connected to the Syrian Protestant College of Beirut. The change worked. Dr. Moyed wrote, "I remember Shoghi Effendi took Arabic for his entrance examination into the SPC. he was very happy and always smiled. Shoghi Effendi attended this school between 1912 to 13, completing his high school senior year during this period, graduating in the early summer. He spent his breaks from school in Haifa and would devote hours to studying and reading until late at night. He was always reading, always studying. Abdu'l-Bahá would sometimes go to his door and say, "Enough, enough, go to sleep." So you can see that quite apart from satisfying class requirements, Shoghi Effendi had an insatiable appetite for knowledge. This urge never left him. It characterized his attitude towards acquiring information about the affairs of the cause during his ministry as guardian. In 1910, when the master was in Ramleh, Alexandria, Shoghi Effendi went there, presumably it was the summer months, a summer vacation from school, to be near him. On this occasion, he met Ali Yazdi, with whom he established a long-lasting friendship. Of the encounter, Ali Yazdi wrote, "We slowly started to get acquainted. You know how children are. Then we got to know each other better. I would see him at Abdu'l-Bahá's house, and gradually we became friends. Even as a child, he was always dignified." Now, in the autumn of 1913, Shoghi Effendi entered the Syrian Protestant College in pursuit of a Bachelor of Arts degree. His friend Ali Yazdi was a student there, as were a number of other young Baha'is. Shoghi Effendi's studies covered a wide array of subjects. I've gone into some detail here to list them from semester to semester to give you an idea, especially the young Baha'is, of what Shoghi Effendi studied and read and what he was interested in. So let's see now. The first semester of his freshman year, 1913 to 14, he studied English, Arabic, French, history, geometry, and the Bible. Of course, he was going to a Protestant school. The Bible was important. Second semester, same subjects, except that history was replaced by biology. During this period, he also participated in a declamation contest in four languages. That, I suppose, was an exercise in elocution. And was the winner of the French language contest held on 12 May 1914. He was also involved in the theater, taking part in a drama, The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, presented at the West Hall Auditorium on 13 June. We're not sure exactly what part he played. World War I broke out while Shoghi Effendi was on summer vacation in Haifa. This is 1914. Despite rumors that the war would spread in the region and that Syria was unsafe, he returned to college in Beirut for the second year of studies. What then did he study? First semester of sophomore year, English, Arabic, French, and you'll notice that English, Arabic, French would be coming up all the time, history, trigonometry, physics, and the Bible. Second semester, English, Arabic, history, analytical geometry, elementary mathematical analysis, biology, and the Bible. In the declamation contest of this period, he again won in the French language. Now, because of the war, many of the Baha'i students, most of whom were Persian, were unable to return to their respective homes during the summer vacation period. They spent the time in Haifa. Where do you suppose they hung out? The anteroom to the shrine of the Bab was assigned to them. Can you imagine such a thing? I was stunned when I read this. The master was so pleased with the work of the students at the Syrian Protestant College, he revealed a tablet in their honor. They did very well. They were doing very well. Concerning these students, Dr. Habib Moyed wrote, "The number of Baha'i students at SPC, many of whom are sent by the master, increased to 35 during this period. As teaching the faith was forbidden in Beirut, Baha'i activities consisted of meeting other Baha'is. The group of students often used to go on picnics with lunches packed by the school, consisting of olives, dates, cheese, and bread. The group went to the mountains and rivers in the vicinity of Beirut for the day and returned in the evening. Shoghi Effendi associated freely and on the same level with the other Baha'is. He was fond of walking, mountain climbing, and swimming in the sea. And he played soccer." Yeah. Yes, he did. Now, Ali Yazdi offers a vivid picture of Shoghi Effendi at this time. Remember the friend that he made in Ramleh? He's at the college also. So he offers a vivid picture of Shoghi Effendi at this time in his academic career. He writes, "At the college, Shoghi Effendi was always jolly, optimistic, and hopeful. He had a wonderful personality. All of a sudden, he would burst forth with loud laughter, or sometimes a smile would break on his face. He had a very small mouth, beautiful expressive eyes, and very regular, handsome features. He was bouncy. He just bounced. Can you imagine the energy that was pouring out of him? He couldn't contain himself. At college, we were in the same dormitory. Shoghi Effendi's room was right across the hall from mine. We would converse on many subjects. We often talked to each other about the future. His vision was always of the faith spreading all over the world and of everybody serving the cause. These were his only ambitions." All right, so let's go to his junior year. First semester, English, Arabic, logic, economics, rhetoric, history, ethics, zoology, and chemistry. Second semester, English, rhetoric, ethics, history, logic, economics, physics, and chemistry. We hop to his senior year, 1916-17. English, rhetoric, Arabic, rhetoric, French, history, economics, psychology, engineering, law, and astronomy. Second semester, French, history, sociology, ethics, and law. Shoghi Effendi graduated along with 9 other students on 13 June 1917, acquiring the degree Bachelor of Arts. Well, that was not to be the end of his association with that school. The college books show that on 9 October 1917, he was registered again as a graduate student. During the summer of 1918, after completing an academic year as a graduate student, Shoghi Effendi returned to the Holy Land. It was at a critical time for the faith. The master's life had been threatened. Jamal Pasha seemed determined to crucify Abdul Baha and his family. But the British advance into the region and the entry of General Allenby's troops into Haifa during September of 1918 eliminated the prospect of any such tragedy. All right, so he's finished his first year of graduate studies. The war has ended. What now? With the ending of the war, Baha'i activities in the world had increased. floods of mail poured into the Holy Land from the United States, Germany, France, India, Burma, and Persia. There was great joy at the opportunity to reestablish communications with Abdu'l-Bahá, which had been cut off, of course, by the conflict. Abdu'l-Bahá began to hear of expanded activities. New believers wrote to him declaring their faith, asking questions, seeking advice, requesting prayers, etc. The need for translating these communications was immediate. Here was Shoghi Effendi's opportunity to do what he had so assiduously been preparing for, to assist the master as a translator. So all of that study of English, French, and so on, you understand. The situation gave his life a new lease. He dedicated himself to serving the master from the summer of 1918 to the spring of 1920. He translated tablets on a variety of subjects as Abdu'l-Bahá responded to the many letters being received. In this work, Shoghi Effendi also became acquainted, through correspondence, with many of the early champions of the cause, such as Dr. Lotfullah Hakim and Dr. John Esselmont. I single these out as examples to see how he got into correspondence with them. Shoghi Effendi initiated correspondence with these individuals especially because of Abdu'l-Bahá's pleasure with their activities and aspirations in service to the cause. In writing to Dr. Esselmont, Shoghi Effendi said, "I now hasten, although late at night, to open a correspondence with you which shall be continuous, inspiring, and regular." This, of course, led to a deep friendship between the two. To Dr. Hakim, he expressed how glad and privileged he was to be able to attend to my beloved services after completing my course of arts and sciences in the American University at Beirut. These are only two examples of the verve that attended his efforts to assist the master and to build good relations with active believers abroad. The flow of tablets from the master and their translation by Shoghi Effendi was creating a great effect on the believers abroad. Shoghi Effendi would soon become known to the friends in the West who had begun publishing his translations of tablets in Star of the West. And Dr. Esselman sort of spilled the beans. He introduced Shoghi Effendi to readers of this magazine in a letter published in Volume 9. It said in part, "I was delighted to receive a copy of the translation of a tablet which Abdu'l-Bahá has written to me. The translation is by Shoghi, a grandson of the master." The list of individuals in the West to whom he sent communications on behalf of the master greatly increased. This was a pleasurable period in his life. He kept a diary that recounted activities at the World Center, which remains a treasure of information about these early days in the work of the faith at its administrative heart. This period of evident happiness for Shoghi Effendi was drawing to a close with the approach of 1920. This would become his last fleeting moments in the presence of Abdu'l-Bahá. During this time, Shoghi Effendi began to be separated from his college friends, too, from the American University at Beirut. The group of Persian students was disappearing, his close friend Ali Yazdi among them. Shoghi Effendi's diary carried a note on these developments dated 24 August 1919. I want to read an excerpt from it. He says, "This week has been, viewed from one aspect, a sad and depressing one. It has witnessed the scattering of friends who during the war and prior to it have been for years held closely and affectionately together by bonds of fellowship and common interest. The student Baha'i group at the American University, that company of young, brilliant, active, and upright men, which has all throughout the war retained, notwithstanding its vicissitudes and blows, its cohesion, is now splitting up. Its numbers mostly graduates of that university departing from that common center. Mr. Ali Yazdi is just starting from Damascus to Haifa, where after meeting with the beloved, he will proceed to Berlin to engage in higher studies. Sad has been the farewell. But the idea that these young men, enlightened and active as they are, may one day each in his own sphere of action render a service to the cause affords sufficient consolation for the hearts that remain behind. Always a hard worker, Shoghi Effendi began to show signs of exhaustion. Concerned, the master sent him to rest and recuperate at a sanatorium in Neuilly, a suburb of Paris. He was accompanied by Dr. Lotfollah Hakim. He entered the sanatorium in April of 1920. Soon thereafter, he wrote to friends stating that his physical health was improving. Two such letters were addressed to Dr. Ali Kuli Khan in Paris. Dr. Ali Kuli Khan had assisted Abdu'l-Bahá when he was in America. As a translator, he was connected with the Persian diplomatic corps there. He did not forget to write to Ali Yazdi, though. His letter to him, dated 8 May 1920, offers a significant insight into his own feelings about his condition and a further glimpse into the depth of their friendship. This is what he said to him. "Dearest Ali, I have not forgotten you, but do you know and realize what crisis I have passed and into what state of health I have fallen? For a month I have stayed and am still staying in this Maison de Convalescence, away from Paris, and its clamor in bed until noon, receiving treatment and following the master's instructions not to open a book during my stay in this place. Be sure, dear friend, that your place in my heart is ever reserved and warm. I wish when I recovered I could come to see you, but I am afraid this is not possible. Your dear father had gone to Port Said for a time when I left Haifa. The master is in splendid health. 14 American pilgrims have arrived. The Holy Land is astir." While at Neuilly, Shoghi Effendi assessed his own work and decided that the quality of his translation of the master's tablets into English needed to be improved. He felt, too, that the English translations had not conveyed the beauty and charm of the originals. Besides, he was not happy about other people's translations of tablets of Baha'u'llah. You'll notice that in his translations, he retranslated many of the works of Baha'u'llah, for instance, the Kitab-i-Ghan, which was first translated by Ali Kuli Khan. Ali Kuli Khan told me himself how he did it. But the Guardian retranslated, it became a marvelous thing. So then, on 11 June 1920, while still at Neuilly, he addressed a letter to Oxford University seeking admission. This is what he said in his letter. "Dear Sir, my esteemed friend Sir Herbert Samuel advises me to write you inquiring about admission as a non-collegiate student at Balliol College or any other college at Oxford University. My sole aim is to perfect my English, to acquire the literary ability to write it well, speak it well, and translate correctly and eloquently from Persian and Arabic into English. My aim is to concentrate for 2 years upon this object and to acquire it through the help of a tutor by attending lectures, by associating with cultured and refined literary circles, and by receiving exercises in phonetics. I would be much obliged if you could help me along that line. Yours very sincerely, Shoghi Rabbani. Isn't that a sweet letter? Shoghi Effendi arrived in the United Kingdom in mid-July 1920, bearing letters from the master addressed to such personages as Lady Blomfield, Lord Lamington, Major Tudor Pole. These letters expressed the master's wish for the education of his grandson. Within a week, Shoghi Effendi secured introductions to eminent Orientalists at Oxford and London universities. Eventually, he got into Balliol College at Oxford. There's no time now, really, to give details of the fascinating story about this. Suffice it to say that a letter of introduction from Sir Walter Raleigh, not that one, to Oxford was effective in initiating the process of entry to the university. What did he study there? Shoghi Effendi's notebook, at least one of them, shows that during the week of 11 to 16 October, which was during what they called a Michaelmas term, he attended lectures on, listen to this, logic, political economy, social and industrial questions, political science, social and political problems, English economic history since 1668. This listing does not give a complete picture, but shows the breadth of his interests. Whatever other subjects occupied him, Shoghi Effendi was determined to master English literary expression. He found that the rise and fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon might provide him with the style of English appropriate as a form of exposition and narrative suitable to presenting the verities and history of the faith. The book became a constant companion, and he was observed, as one person reported, walking up and down the inner quad in the grass on many occasions, reading Gibbon's Decline and Fall as he walked, sometimes I believe, aloud. Students also reported his interest in the Bible. Remember, he had studied it quite a bit in Beirut. He had, of course, studied the Bible during his student years in Beirut, but he was interested in the literary qualities of the writing. Amatul Baha confirmed that Shoghi Effendi was interested in both books. She wrote this, I think it's in the Priceless Pearl. He was a great reader of the King James Version of the Bible and of the historians Carlyle and Gibbon, whose styles he greatly admired, particularly that of Gibbon, whose Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire Shoghi Effendi was so fond of that I never remember his not having a volume of it near him in his room and usually with him when he traveled. There was a small everyman's copy of part of it next to his bed when he died. It was his own pet Bible of the English language, and often he would read to me excerpts from it, and interrupting himself with exclamations such as, "Oh, what a style, what a command of English, what rolling sentences, listen to this." I particularly remember one peaceful hour, so rare, alas, when he sat on a bench facing the lake on a summer afternoon in St. James's Park in London, and he read me Gibbon out loud. He reveled in him, and throughout Shoghi Effendi's writings, the influence of his style may clearly be seen, just as the biblical English is reflected in his translations of Baha'u'llah's prayers, the hidden words, and tablets. Indeed, in one of his world order letters, in two substantial paragraphs, he practically, in a series of questions, summarizes chapter 16 of Gibbon. This listing does not give, of course, a complete picture. I said that before, didn't I? Yeah. All right, so he's into Gibbon and Bible and political science and all these other things that he became absorbed in. But time is running out. The demands of his unique destiny hung heavily now, unbeknownst to him. 29 November 1921, 9:30 a.m., London. A cable reached the office of Major Tudor Pole. It bore two brief but devastating sentences. His Holiness Abdu'l-Bahá ascended Abha Kingdom. Inform friends. This was signed by the greatest holy leaf. In notifying the friends, Major Tudor Pole must have invited Shoghi Effendi by telephone to come to his office. Upon arriving in London at about noon, Shoghi Effendi went to Major Tudor Pole's address and was shown into his private office. Abdu'l-Bahá suggests in The Priceless Pearl that, quote, Tudor Pole was not in the room at the moment, but as Shoghi Effendi stood there, his eye was caught by the name Abdu'l-Bahá on the open cablegram lying on the desk. And he read it. When Tudor Pole entered the room a moment later, he found Shoghi Effendi in a state of collapse, dazed and bewildered by this catastrophic news. He was taken to the home of Miss Grand, one of the London believers, and put to bed there for a few days. Tudor Pole informed Star of the West 2 days later that Shoghi Effendi Shoghi Rabbani and his sister will be returning to Haifa towards the end of the present month, and they will be accompanied by Lady Blomfield and Sia'ullah Asgharzadeh. In the meantime, Shoghi Effendi had been invited by Dr. Esselmont to come to his home, and he spent some time in Bournemouth. From there, he wrote of his feelings in a letter to a Baha'i student in London. This is what he had to say in part. The terrible news has for some days so overwhelmed my body, my mind, and my soul that I was laid for a couple of days in bed almost senseless, absent-minded, and greatly agitated. Gradually, his, meaning God's, power revived me and breathed in me a confidence that I hope will henceforth guide me and inspire me in my humble work of service. The day has come, but how sudden and unexpected. The fact, however, that his cause has created so many and such beautiful souls all over the world is a sure guarantee that it will live and prosper, and ere long will compass the world. I am immediately starting for Haifa to receive the instruction he has left, and have now made a supreme determination to dedicate my life to his service and by his aid to carry out his instructions all the days of my life. The stir which is now aroused in the Baha'i world is an impetus to this cause, and will awaken every faithful soul to shoulder the responsibilities which the Master has now placed upon every one of us. The Holy Land will remain the focal center of the Baha'i world. A new era will now come upon it. The Master, in his great vision, has consolidated his work, and his Spirit assures me that its results will soon be made manifest. I am starting with Lady Blomfield for Haifa, and if we are delayed in London for our passage, I shall then come to see you and tell you how marvelously the Master has designed his work after him and what remarkable utterances he has pronounced with regard to the future of the cause. Overcoming passport difficulties, which delayed his return to the Holy Land, he sailed from England on 16 December and arrived in Haifa by train from Egypt on 29 December. He had not a clue what to expect. Abdu'l-Bahá had left his will and testament in an envelope addressed to Shoghi Effendi. A few days after his arrival, his family read it to him. No one can really know the effect upon him of the awesome information it conveyed. His appointment as guardian, successor of Abdu'l-Bahá, was totally unexpected. Amatul-Bahá wrote that the most he had expected was that perhaps because he was the eldest grandson, Abdu'l-Bahá might have left instructions as to how the Universal House of Justice was to be elected, and he might have been designated the one to see these were carried out and act as convener of the gathering which would elect it. And so, Shoghi Effendi had now been thrust into a momentous solitude. He took time away from the Holy Land to become reconciled to the terrible challenge now facing him. The story of what he did in this regard will have to await another opportunity. So, in closing, let's think. What are the impressions of Shoghi Effendi as guardian? What was he like as guardian? We know a lot about his childhood and his adolescence and his early adulthood. What was he like as guardian? Amatul-Bahá provides us with insights from her vantage point as his consort. I've picked out some nuggets from these. He was stern in all matters affecting the protection of the faith. He was fussy about sources of information. He had few personal relationships above and beyond his usual affection and goodwill towards the friends. On one side, he was so majestic, on the other, so engagingly confiding, innocent-hearted, and youthful. He was very tenacious of his purposes, very determined, but never unreasonable. He might be deflected from his course, but never defeated in his purpose. His ingenuity was remarkable. Economy was a very rigid principle with him. Openness was a marked characteristic. Through 36 years of prodigious activity, he carried out his designated responsibility both in literary and practical terms as interpreter of the vision of world unity advanced by Baha'u'llah. The potential of the incomparably diverse but united global community he raised up is to become a pattern for future society. Anyone acquainted with its workings will be impressed by the spirit that induces its coherence. The sheer volume and efficiency of his output in any one of his vocations as exegete, author, translator, administrator, commentator on world trends, master planner, organizer of global undertakings, aesthete, is astounding. But it is the rarity of his inspired insight that lent a singular quality to his varied occupations and that remains as an exceptional and potent legacy. Hence, we here can bear witness to the truth of Abdu'l-Bahá's prediction when he replied to that inquiry from the Western believer. His face will shine with a radiance that illumines all the horizons of the world. Ages and centuries will bear traces of him. So let's look at some pictures. Salutations and praise, blessing and glory rest upon that primal branch of the divine Lord tree, grown out, blessed, tender, verdant, and flourishing from the twin holy trees, the most wondrous, unique, and priceless pearl that doth gleam from out the twin surging seas.